Before we begin, a brief content warning. This episode contains discussion of intersex issues, including childhood surgical interventions and their long-term effects. Some listeners may find this difficult, and it may be inappropriate for younger ears. Please exercise your best judgment.
I'm ready to kind of connect with people in a genuine way or not at all, yeah. You know? And so to me, you know, I deal with a lot of people that sort of feel like the conventional wisdom of my story of being intersex is like, hey, what, you know, like keep that on the down low, you know, yeah. Like why are you sharing that? I think because of my lived experience, I have like, I got to tell you this because this is a deal breaker for me. Like yeah. This is who I am. This is what I've been through. I'm not trying to force anything on yeah. you, but this is me at my most authentic.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Collective Table Podcast. This is Jason Coker, and I'll be your host for today. If this is your first episode, Janelle and I have spent this whole season making the case for empathy. And we've been doing that by telling people's stories in a way that, we hope, makes it really clear just how good and vital empathy is to this whole business of being human. And maybe you've noticed, but one thing we've learned is this. If the essence of empathy is to understand people who are different than you are, that requires the willingness to cross borders of one kind or another. Well, today's story is all about crossing borders of a different kind. Societal borders, family borders, medical borders, even the borders of one's own self and one's own body. This is Tindo's story. Janelle and I first met Tindo at Pride by the Beach, an annual festival hosted every June here in downtown Oceanside by the local North County LGBTQ Resource Center. Tindo showed up at church the very next day, and within a day or two, emailed me an article. I mean, I meet a lot of people, right?
Right.
And I don't think I've ever had the experience of meeting somebody and then having them send me an email that's like, here's this article from the Chicago Reader.
I got something to tell you.
I want you to read. And I was like, I think this Tindo person's trying to tell me something.
Like, let me just full disclosure what you're dealing with here.
The article Tindo sent was a 2018 piece from the Chicago Tribune written by Nara Schoenberg. In it, Schoenberg profiles several Chicago area people who are intersex, including Tindo, who was originally from Chicago and back in 2018 was still going by the name Cynthia. More on that later. It's important to understand that people born under the umbrella term intersex have bodies that don't fit binary notions of male or female. This happens for several reasons. Sometimes they're born with female XX chromosomes and have internal ovaries, but externally their genitalia are ambiguous or male-presenting. Sometimes it's the opposite. They're born with male XY chromosomes, but their genitalia are ambiguous or female-appearing. There are also people born with XXY chromosomes. This is known as Klinefelter syndrome and is generally included in the definition of intersex because it usually affects male sex development, resulting in reduced testosterone, small testes, and infertility. There are also people born with XYY chromosomes. This is known as Jacobs syndrome and is usually excluded from the definition of intersex because it doesn't often cause problems with sex development. You may think you don't know anyone who is intersex, but chances are you do. It's quite common for intersex people to be unaware of it until they reach adolescence or even adulthood when they encounter complications in their sexual development. In some cases, people never discover this about themselves. And because of that, it's hard to know exactly how many intersex people there are. But our best estimate is they represent about 1.7% of the population. And that translates to about 5.6 million people in the United States, roughly equal to the number of Americans with naturally occurring red hair. Human bodies, of course, exhibit a broad range of variety. That includes our genitals. So sometimes at birth, doctors will visually classify an intersex person as male or female because their genitals appear within the usual range of human differences. But other times, intersex people are born with genitals that don't appear to fit our binary notions of sex. And until very recently, when that happened, doctors would very commonly, with permission from the parents, surgically alter that baby's genitals to fit society's notion of what counts as normal. And that is what happened to Tindo.
The reality of my life is it came, you know, the world view came at me with a scalpel and,
literally,
I mean, literally. Yeah. And so, and I don't mean to say like, ooh, you know, I've been carved up like a Virginia ham, but it's like that was the solution of the world. The world said, we fix you.
These surgeries often involve reducing the size of the clitoris, enlarging vaginal cavities, construction of a penis, and the removal of gonads. Most of these are medically unnecessary procedures, but they have very serious consequences, including scarring, trouble urinating, difficulty menstruating, recurring urinary tract infections, and later in adulthood, pain during sexual arousal and orgasm, or loss of sexual function altogether. It's common for these problems to require multiple follow-up surgeries to address these complications. On top of this, intersex persons often experience psychological distress when their hormones or gender identities or sexual attractions run contrary to the social expectations of their assigned sex. The pain and trauma caused by these kinds of struggles, which become especially acute starting in adolescence, can be severe. According to some studies, intersex people attempt suicide at rates of up to 20% higher than the general population. Given all this, it's important to keep in mind that intersex children did not and cannot consent to these procedures. And that is one of the most painful wounds they experience.
Because I didn't even know it all. My father's retired physician. I didn't even have all my medical records. You know, it's like I started this slow process of like, you know, what can I find out about this? And, you know, going back to the hospital back in Illinois where this was, you know, the early interventions were performed on me. Mm-hmm. You know, are there archival records, which is not always, you know, easily, you know, obtained. And I was able to get mine and, you know, like, whoa, this actually happened.
Tindo's story was largely concealed by their parents. And Tindo was well into midlife by the time they went digging for their medical records. But what they know is this. They were born in Chicago in 1965 and declared a boy at birth. Their parents named them Stephen. Sometime later, having concluded that Stephen's anatomy was more complicated than had been anticipated, doctors at Children's Memorial Hospital in Evanston, Illinois, determined Stephen would do better as a girl. Surgery was performed on them at 3 months old to reconstruct female genitalia. Stephen was renamed Cynthia.
And like, there's my dad's signature, giving consent to have my, you know, have my body, you know, operated on. And, you know, you're sort of like reading, you know, like the biography of your life that somebody else wrote. You're like, whoa, like this happened to me.
Later, the family moved to San Diego, and throughout their childhood as Cynthia, Tindo felt conspicuously different in a way they couldn't quite understand. They remember being more modest than the other girls and felt out of place in the usual girl spaces and struggled with social expectations of femininity. They weren't in touch with the complicated reality of their intersex body. And that led to real challenges and confusion.
And then that led into like the junior high years was mm-hmm. when I was taken for the first time to an endocrinologist to like, you know, okay, as my mother, you know, put it, you know, she came into my room like the night before we were going to go to a doctor's appointment. She basically tried to frame it as like, well, we're going to get you started on your period. And like for me, I wasn't a girl that was like, oh, when am I going to get my period? You know, it wasn't like, you know, when's my turn to become a woman, mom? Yeah. You know, like I was really kind of more of like a wannabe tomboy.
Tindo's parents did everything they could to reinforce their femininity.
And my mother, who was overtly very kind of feminine and very feminine presenting and yeah. very womanly, she was sort of tasked with like, okay, it's time for you to go through the change here. And,
right.
And it was like, okay, I'm like, what's going to happen to me? You know, because I was more of kind of a clodhopper, like, you know, why do we have to do this? But I also wasn't rebellious. I wasn't a real hellraiser. It was kind of like her, like, okay, you know, this is womanhood, you yeah. know, like it or not.
It was especially her mother's job to teach her how to be a girl and grow up to be a woman. This caused real tension in their relationship.
I wasn't really into it, but I didn't push back. They right. might have thought it wasn't, you know, like I wasn't that compliant.
Right.
But, you know, probably because they saw, I think a lot for them, like what I was picking up was like a vibe of anxiety from them. And I was sort of thinking like, why are mom and dad so uptight? Because they were looking for signs of everything going well.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what's the goal here?
Cynthia joined their mother in women's groups and activities at church. They joined a women's philanthropic organization together. As a teenager, they volunteered as a candy striper in the local hospital. Tindo's parents even signed up Cynthia to participate in the long-running and prestigious La Jolla Debutante Ball in San Diego.
I was a debutante. My parents had me in
what?
I was formally debuted into society, presented to society at the Hotel Del Coronado. I had, you know, I donned a lovely white dress of purity, and, you know, my brothers and my dad all were dressed up in a tuxedo, and, you know, here we are, here's our lovely daughter who we originally thought was a boy at birth, and we named Stephen Johnson, and lo and behold, that's not what the doctors thought was best. So now we have Cynthia Ann, you know, right. And it's just this whole like, okay, let's pretend.
All told, Tindo spent the better part of 50 years living as Cynthia. Several years later, after their mother passed away, Tindo was done pretending. This reckoning with who they had been also produced a genuine understanding and empathy for their other selves. And this led to new possibilities for who they might become.
Tindo is a nickname I yeah. was given as a child. And as I, when I got to a point, like, you know, you can say, when did you become Tindo? Like yeah. you were Cynthia.
Yeah.
Well, I was Stephen for yeah. 3.5 months. And then it was Cynthia. When did Cynthia say, I'm done with, you know, that was probably like around 5 years, five or 6 years ago.
Yeah. Which is pretty recent.
Pretty recent. Yeah. I mean, I'm 60. So yeah. it's like, all right, in new situations, I have the
yes.
freedom to start fresh and say, okay, now because I'm dealing with a fresh community and fresh faces, I can start fresh
yes.
as Tindo
yeah.
and define myself and who I am and my experience and how I want to be hopefully be seen and show up authentically.
Everyone, it's CJ. We hope you're enjoying the collective table and finding something meaningful here. Something that connects with your heart and your journey. If you are, we'd love for you to help others find it too. The best way to do that is simple. Rate and follow the collective table wherever you listen to podcasts. When you follow, you'll never miss a new episode. And when you leave a rating or a short review, it helps more people discover this community of love, liberation, and faith in action. And while you're at it, share an episode with a friend, someone you think might find encouragement, hope, or inspiration in these conversations. It only takes a moment, but it makes a big difference. So go ahead, tap that follow button, leave us a quick review, and share The Collective Table with someone who could use it today. Thanks for listening and for being a part of The Collective Table.
Tindo's story explicitly reveals something that I think is true for all of us, that the hardest borders to cross exist within ourselves, across competing desires, beliefs, and identities. In Tindo's case, the competing identities were stark. Tindo was Cynthia for 5 decades, and before that, Stephen for just 3 months. The gender binary that is external to most of us is deeply inscribed on Tindo's body and mind. And that battle was being reinforced on both sides by hormonal changes, family dynamics, and social pressures.
The story of my life, you know, born intersex, had this whole, oh my God, something's different about this child. There's a bodily difference, you know, that was socially alarming. It was a source of, anguish and uncertainty and fear, for my parents and what do we do? And in their otherwise perfect Norman Rock, everything's going perfectly. And then here comes this different child. And it really set the tone, it's kind of, sort of set things in a different direction for my parents.
More than anything, what comes through in conversation with Tindo about this journey is the work they've done to empathize with their parents.
I've really been on an empathy journey of reconciling my feelings about what happened to me, my parents' role, the decisions they made, without my consent. But, now looking back going, if I were them, what happened to me was not unreasonably unreasonable for who they were and for the times.
At this point in the conversation, Tindo really steps into their parents' shoes and demonstrates an ability to use their imagination to truly understand where their parents were coming from.
You got to look at that snapshot of these were young people that they came from a lived experience of this is how the world is and everything was going great for them. My dad was just, starting his career as a doctor. My mom was already had my 2 older brothers and she's a mother and she came from her own family dynamic of adversity as a young girl. So it's everything was going great. And then, here I come. So for me, in doing the hard work of sort of self-realization and looking at my own life, I have to also revisit it from the lens of their lived experience. And that's been a process.
Over the past 3 decades, psychologists have begun to rethink the long-standing assumption that trauma leaves only damage in its wake. The field of post-traumatic growth, pioneered by Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun in the mid-1990s, emerged as researchers noticed a consistent pattern. Many survivors not only recovered from trauma, but experienced deeper meaning, stronger relationships, and a renewed sense of personal strength, precisely because their old assumptions about life had been shattered. This framework shifted the conversation from "What did trauma do to you?" to the more positive frame, "What can emerge in you because of what you lived through?" Within this evolving landscape, the role of self-empathy, often studied as self-compassion, has become increasingly central. Scholars such as Kristen Neff and Paul Gilbert have shown that the way we relate to our own suffering profoundly shapes whether trauma is integrated or avoided. It seems to be the case that when people can turn toward their pain with gentleness, curiosity, and a sense of shared humanity rather than self-criticism or shame, they open the psychological space required for the deeper work of meaning-making. Recent studies demonstrate that this kind of self-empathy predicts higher levels of post-traumatic growth by lowering internalized blame, which calms the body's threat response and enables the reflective processing that leads to growth. In this sense, self-empathy becomes a kind of inner scaffolding. It holds us steady as we confront what we would rather not feel, giving us the stability to ask more transformative questions like, who am I? What's my purpose? And how can I connect with others? In this way, far from being toxic, self-empathy is emerging as one of the most powerful spiritual tools we have for surviving trauma and growing personally. It's not hard to recognize this pattern in Tindo's story. They ask these same questions with gentleness, curiosity, and courage, and it has led to greater growth and empathy for their parents. But it has also taken years, and that work isn't finished.
I'm glad I still have this relationship with my father. I see him weekly, and that's important to me. Yeah. And the arc of that relationship is very much one of like a change. I see the change in him. You know, he still holds, holds tight to his foundation of like, well, this is what it means to be human. And I only can know this and this and, all of this, they, them, theirs. And, going by Tindo.
But they keep working at it. And there's a sense of hope in the process.
And I'm hoping to get there. Like I feel like I'm on this journey of getting to a place where he's going to be 90 in November. And it's like, is it possible that we could have this on Golden Pond moment where Jane Fonda says to her, curmudgeonly old father, I feel like we've always been mad at each other, but I want to be friends with you, And I am friends with my dad and we do have a lot of love, but this history, this narrative, it's burned deep into both of us.
This is a harder process for Tindo's memories of their mother. She was the one responsible for socializing Tindo into being a girl, and in that sense was the source of much of their pain.
Yeah, it's a gift, and it's also it's the jagged little pill. Yeah. If I'm gonna have fond,
I appreciate you dropping an Alanis Morissette.
if I'm gonna have fond feelings for her, it's because I'm gonna have to create them. I'm gonna have to want them.
Yeah,
and which is very much like the spiritual path. If we're gonna want this, love of our fellow man, we're gonna have to work at it.
But because their mother is no longer around, the anger related to years of hurt and being socialized into an identity that didn't fit is harder to process.
Oh, that's all there. It's all there.
Yeah.
And yet it's sort of like you realize like anger and that kind of fury and rage and that's kind of like a quick snack, I just want to have my, self-righteous indignation. But the real banquet of being human is like seeing the whole story.
Hello, Collective Table listeners. It's CJ again. A lot of people out there might not realize that this podcast is part of a real-life faith community. The Collective Table podcast is a production of the Oceanside Sanctuary, a progressive Christian community whose mission is to foster collective expressions of inclusive, inspiring, and impactful Christian spirituality wherever it is needed. And as a 501c3 nonprofit organization, that mission is only possible because of the generosity of people just like you. So if you believe in what we are doing, if you benefit from this mission, please visit us at oceansidesanctuary.org/give to become a supporter today. Together we can keep building communities of love and liberation.
Tindo's the first to point out that this is spiritual work. In Matthew chapter 19, some fellow teachers approach Jesus and ask, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause?" What's not mentioned in the text is that They're essentially inviting Jesus into a well-known debate between two influential rabbis at that time. And the debate was this. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4, states that a man can divorce his wife if he finds something, quote, indecent about her. Now, Rabbi Shammai taught that this text refers to one thing and one thing only, sexual infidelity. That was the only acceptable reason, according to Rabbi Shammai, that you could divorce your wife. But Rabbi Hillel taught that a husband could legitimately find nearly anything to be indecent, including preparing a bad meal. Jesus' questioners want to know where he stands in this debate. Jesus answers that men should not be allowed to simply discard their wives for any trivial reason. This isn't a way of trapping women in marriage. It's a way of protecting them from being made destitute by the cruel and fickle whims of their husbands. But there's something fascinating about Jesus' response. First, while he agrees with Rabbi Shammai, he's uninterested in the precise legal meaning of the Hebrew word erwa in Deuteronomy 24, which is translated into English as either indecent or shameful. And that's surprising because the whole debate hangs on how that word is interpreted. But Jesus ignores that. Instead, he points to the creation story and reminds his fellow rabbis that marriage joins together the tensions of masculine and feminine in a way that no man should separate. Jesus implies something here that Philo of Alexandria stated explicitly. Philo was a Jewish philosopher who lived in Egypt during Jesus' lifetime. And he pointed out that the first human at the beginning of creation, the Ha-Adam in Genesis 1:27, is depicted by the text as androgynous. Man and woman as gender distinctions did not exist until Genesis 2:22 and 23, when God splits Adam into two distinct people. In other words, before Eve was created, Adam was intersex. Marriage, then, for Jesus, is a symbol of the ontological reality that being human means embracing and reuniting these opposing tensions. Not surprisingly, then, Tindo finds great personal resonance with this passage.
When you're on a path of faith, you want to believe that there's something foundational about it that resonates as true for you personally. Like, where is the personal truth for me in the Bible, you know? And to have, to have this person of historic, position, Jesus, make reference in red ink, and to see the written word, but the spoken word of God, of Jesus, or God in the form of Jesus, say, we all know there are eunuchs.
This is the other really fascinating part of Matthew 19. When his disciples hear that men shouldn't just be able to discard their wives whenever they felt like it, they were alarmed. Maybe they say it's better not to marry at all. Jesus responds by saying, well, there are other options. We all know there are eunuchs. Some are born, some are made, and some choose to be eunuchs. Jesus is doing more here than simply saying, hey, you can always be single. For him, the category of eunuch seems to operate as a category of being that falls outside the binary of male and female.
And of course, he's preaching on marriage, and that there are some that, may not qualify. And that's another aspect of my story that I sort of grapple with. Like, okay, so you're embracing this idea of being a born eunuch, someone who's born different. And Jesus is saying, yeah, we know that there are sort of qualifiers for marriage, and being a eunuch may be one that, sort of precludes you, from having this blessing.
If we take Jesus' words at face value, he seems to be divorcing gender from sex by acknowledging that some people, despite their genitalia, may not be bound by the same social expectations to marry. Tyndale finds a lifeline in this brief passage. How do those words in red, as right. you put it, how does that relieve some hurt for you? How does that relieve some pressure for you?
Because so much of the narrative and the lived experience of being intersex is a feeling of I'm wrong. Mm. I came into the world in a way that was registered as wrong, yeah. as this is abhorrent. This is, you know, anathema to what we are. You know, there's only yeah. men, there's only women. Yeah. And it's like we have, you're a mystery. And there I have this wonderful sort of vindication. Mm-hmm. I have an acknowledgement and validation from the one mm-hmm. source that, like, whose other opinion matters, right? Yeah. Like, it should be everybody else saying yeah. the same thing, but it's like, I have it in red ink from the guy.
So does that help you live into that with some pride?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's like, I got my tap on the shoulder, like, you're Tyndale, you know, this is God saying, you're good. We know you. Like, he's saying, we all know these people.
Yeah.
Like, where are we hearing that in society today? Like, yeah. Is our president saying, well, yeah. we all know there are know.
Yeah.
No, we're not. And it's so to me, it's like, I'm good. Like if this is the hill I'm going to die on, like I'm okay with that.
A growing body of queer, feminist, and intersex-affirming scholarship argues that Jesus' reference here to three types of eunuchs in Matthew 19 signals an intentional recognition of gender diversity. In the ancient world, eunuchs were widely understood as gender liminal or third gender figures, lacking the reproductive markers that defined normative masculinity. By affirming eunuchs from birth and those who embody non-procreative lives, quote, for the sake of the kingdom, Jesus grants positive theological value to people whose bodies or identities don't conform to binary norms. These interpreters see this passage as opening space for gender expansive and gender transgressive identities within the life of the kingdom of God.
And that's why it's like, thank you, Jesus, for making it okay.
Yeah.
And it's like, there are people who are invoking your name, you yes. know, to come after me.
Right.
And it's like, I got very loudly. And so, and I've thought about this. I'm like, if I had to go before like a congressional panel and say, hey, pull out your Bibles there, Mr. Yeah. you know, Southern Republican, you know, yeah. I mean, like, and not coming after anyone because they're Republican or from a Southern state yeah. or, but it's like, would that even register with them? Is like, would that even matter to them?
This is not hypothetical. On April 10th, 2025, during the floor debate over the Texas state budget, Republican Representative Andy Hopper and Democrat Lauren Ashley Simmons had this tense exchange.
Gender is not a social construct. It's firmly rooted in biological reality.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
I said gender is not a social construct.
Okay, so again, intersex people, what about them? We were talking about two biological sexes. What are we talking about when we're regarding intersex people?
Yeah, could you explain it one more time? I think we all would like to have an explanation where we can understand it. I think we're quite following.
You are not sure what intersex people are, if they exist or not, but you want to defund a program about something that you don't quite understand. I'm trying. That's why I'm seeking clarification.
Yeah. So, the truth that is rooted in our biblical understanding that God set forth from the beginning of creation is that your gender is fixed at birth and you cannot change it.
You haven't yet answered my question about where do intersex people fall into that equation?
Yeah, those intersex individuals are still XX or XY, so you can't change that.
At issue here was Representative Hopper's amendment to eliminate state funding for the University of Texas at Austin and other public universities for including diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. This moment underscores how efforts to legislate narrow understandings of sex, gender, or identity are based on deeply ignorant premises, divorced from any scientific reality. More to the point, these efforts seek to deny access to resources for people who are often the most vulnerable and normalize stigmas that will further endanger their safety. The embarrassing irony of Andy Hopper's words is that he clumsily appeals to the Bible when, as we've seen, the Bible actually acknowledges a gender spectrum. And that isn't only true for ancient Jewish culture. A wide variety of non-Western cultures embrace gender plural categories. These include the Hijras of India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, the Wariyas of Indonesia, the Katoy of Thailand, the Fa'afa'fene of Samoa, the Ashtime of Ethiopia, the Mahu of Hawaii, Tahiti, and Polynesia, and the two-spirit people found in many Native American tribes in North and South America. Many of these are genuine third genders, not unlike Jesus's eunuchs. In other cases, they reflect a kind of gender fluidity that mirrors that particular culture's god or gods, not unlike the God of the Hebrew Bible, who is frequently called by the Hebrew name El Shaddai, which can be translated as the many-breasted one, because of God's maternal characteristics.
What does that mean? You know, what does that mean to somebody who would come to me, you know, who would come after me, you know, in 2025 and say, no, we're not having this third gender, you know, no, we're going to send you to the doctor and you're going to get put through the meat grinder and you're going to come out a boy or a girl, depending about what we as society feels, you know, is the most, you know, reasonable approach to deal with your situation. Yeah. Like, well, we'll still go ahead and fix these funny looking kids and their funny looking genitals because we can't have that.
I mean, I don't know how many of our congregants will listen to this interview, but if I were like, oh yeah, I interviewed, you know, Cynthia for the podcast, people would be like, who's Cynthia? But if I said, I interviewed Cynthia or Tindo for the podcast, right, everybody would know who Tindo is. Right. Like everybody knows who Tindo is.
Right.
Like you are very well known here and loved here for who you are.
I feel it. And that's why I'm here. You're in your faith home, your spiritual home, my faith community, I should say, when you feel like you're seen, and I feel seen here.
Thank you, friends, for joining us here at the Collective Table Podcast. I hope you enjoyed hearing Tindo's story. If so, would you please do me a favor and do two things. Subscribe so you'll be sure to get all of our updates. And then share this episode with a friend. Even better, share the whole season. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. The Collective Table is created by Jason and Janelle Coker and is a production of the Oceanside Sanctuary Church in Oceanside, California. This podcast is directed, edited, and produced by Nico Butler. Theme music composed by Nico Butler. From all of us here, may the peace of God be with you.